I'd like to introduce Steve Collins. Steve is an attitude engineer. So keep your attitude straight. He drives starships, drives spacecraft, and he's going to talk about some of the stuff that he does with Tickle and just does. And Steve will be here for most of the week, and I highly recommend that if you get a chance, say hello, talk with him. He's a neat guy.
I'm on. One, two, hello. Hello. I don't usually need one of these in a room of this ilk, but we'll go this way and see. Let's see. Ah, there we go. So, you know that's what it is. My name is Steve Collins, and I'm an engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. My specialty is attitude control, and what that means is I'm responsible for all the stuff on a spacecraft that keeps it pointed in the right direction. The thrusters, gyroscopes, reaction wheels if you have them, and typically the attitude control subsystem also is responsible for making corrections to the spacecraft trajectory. If the navigators say, we need to go a little bit to the left, we're the guys that go and figure out how do you actually do that with the spacecraft, what direction do we turn the spacecraft, and how much do we fire the thrusters to change the trajectory. There's a picture of a somewhat typical spacecraft. There's a bunch of things you have to worry about when you're doing that job. Spacecraft have a lot of constraints on how they can be pointed. Typically, there's solar panels, science instruments, various kinds of sensors on the spacecraft that you have to worry about how they're oriented. The typical things are keeping the solar arrays pointed at the sun, keeping the antenna pointed so that you can have communications with the Earth, and making sure you don't get sun on the dark side of the spacecraft. Spacecraft are typically built with a side that's designed to be out in the sun and a side that's supposed to be in the cold blackness of shadow in space. If you get them wrong way around, they don't like it very well. That's a drawing of Deep Space One, which is a project I worked on several years ago. It was a technology demonstrator of an ion propulsion system. The concept was we would build this thing and fly it around the solar system some and prove to ourselves that we knew how to run an ion propulsion system in space. There's a picture of the spacecraft with the ion engine running in the vacuum chamber at JPL during one of the tests. And the ion engine makes this really cool blue glow that shoots off down the vacuum chamber. It ionizes xenon atoms and uses an electrostatic field to accelerate them. And the ion engine on DS1 makes about as much thrust as a piece of paper weighs, which is not a whole lot of oomph. But if you can run it for a year straight and keep it pointed in the right direction, that can put a lot of delta V on the spacecraft. The ion engine that we had on the spacecraft put about as much delta V on it as the whole launch vehicle after we launched. So what's the connection to TCL? Well, I guess let me jump back a little bit to kind of where I came from. I have a bachelor's degree in physics and was always really interested in space stuff. I did my bachelor's degree thesis on orbital mechanics and rendezvous. And I wrote a bunch of simulations on a Commodore 64 orbital mechanics stuff, which, you know, so I was too cheap to go buy a dot matrix printer, which were several hundred dollars at the time. And so I drew them on the screen, drew the graphics of these plots of these simulations on the screen and then traced them off onto tracing paper and used Xerox machines to put them in my thesis and stuff. So I, you know, started fooling around with Commodore 64s and taught myself 6502 assembler from that, and then moved to the Amiga, and you know, started fooling around with graphics stuff. Was always, you know, real interested in the space stuff, and kind of had this, well, I want to like learn how to teach myself how to do 3D graphics. I wrote in machine language for the 6502 a little 3D graphics package that had a floating point routines and stuff like that that worked in one byte mantises and a bunch of crazy stuff. And that eventually evolved into this thing called T-Ball. And what T-Ball is it's a 3D representation of the spacecraft embedded in the celestial sphere. You can kind of think of the sphere as being the sky, and the spacecraft is down there in the middle, and you can plot stuff on the sphere. You could think of it as plotting it in right ascension and declination, but with the advantage that you can kind of turn the sphere around and look at it from any direction. Typically, how this has been done is people make Mercator projection plots of stuff, and that is oftentimes hard to interpret because it kind of stretches the geometry when you get up near the poles and stuff like that. And after I got out of school, I worked for a small company. A guy named Jim Wirtz ran this thing, and he's kind of a big name in the attitude control field. And he is real big on spherical geometry and drawing stuff on spheres, and used to give us stacks of graph paper that had spheres on them, and we would draw all our stuff on spheres. So that's kind of how I came into that. What you see there is you see the version of T-Ball that I built for Deep Space One, and you can see all the green stuff on there are constraints. And you kind of get an idea of the complexity of the constraint stuff that you have to worry about with the spacecraft. There's stuff on there that, these big diagonal lines have to do with keeping the solar panels on the sun, and all of these, there's a little narrow slot up here that the sun can actually move up into, and it's okay, but these are to keep the sun off of various science instruments and stuff like that. Here's the TCL sort of part of my talk. So this thing, this tool is a 3D representation of the spacecraft, and it lets you draw the Earth and Sun and Moon on the sky, where the sensor fields of view are for a given orientation of the spacecraft, the different antenna patterns. If you have a high-gain antenna, how big is that? How far can the Earth be from the center of it and still have communications? And then maybe stars, if you're doing something that is related to the star tracker. And you can zoom this in, so that you can look at very small changes in the attitude, and you can look at it from any side of the spacecraft. We typically have a few standard reference frames that we do stuff in, either, right ascension and declination, which is the term we use for that is J2000, or sometimes it's more useful to sit kind of in the body of the spacecraft and look at how things move if you were on the spacecraft. And this thing can get telemetry from our telemetry system, which is called DMD, or you can get telemetry out of a big telemetry database that we have at JPL, and it comes out as a huge, monstrous, many 100-megabyte text files, and it can swallow those things and show the orientation of the spacecraft from that. The pieces that it's built up out of, it has a TCL interpreter in the front end of it, and I use that for all of the, drawing the windows and the regular graphical user interface stuff that you can do with TCL TK. And you can tell that I'm off of the reservation, because I think you guys pretty much all say tickle. Is that accepted, or is there still kind of a... It's both ways? Yeah, I kind of live in my own little universe without too much contact to the outside world or or the Tickle community. You know, we've been talking about how the way that I've done stuff is kind of, you know, a couple revs back, but it's working, you know, and so I don't want to mess with it too much. I use this to do the 3D stuff. Brian Paul and another guy whose name I can't remember built this thing called TOGL, which is a widget for TK that lets you draw OpenGL stuff in it. And there's probably, you know, three other people have made newer versions of that same sort of thing, but that's kind of what it's based on. But that let me, you know, do the graphic stuff and have TCL TK together. I found this TCL readline stuff so that I can do command line editing in my TCL interpreter, which there's probably somebody, if you know, tell me a better way to do that. You know, the 3D graphics of drawing the little spacecraft and stuff like that's all done with OpenGL. And then I have, you know, the stuff that I built are this, you know, quaternion libraries. That's the how we do the mathematics of the rotations of spacecraft and, you know, all the coordinate transformations and stuff. There's a wonderful tool that that they've built at JPL for dealing with trajectories and, you know, various other geometry stuff called the SPICE libraries. And that's how I get information about where the spacecraft is and the various bodies in the solar system. It's really well documented. You know, it's really a nice package to include. The TCL stuff I do... the graphical user interface, the main event loop of it, the, you know, handling all the mouse drags and all of that stuff is all done with TCL. The stuff that I want to do in real time or anything that I feel like, well, when I'm running this, I may want to, like, be able to hack stuff on the fly without, like, recompiling the whole thing. Or I, you know, tend to do that stuff in some sort of TCL scripting world. All the stuff that needs to be really fast, you know, I end up doing in C, the you know, how I plot great circles on this sphere and that sort of stuff. And then, you know, for reading these giant, you know, sometimes gigabyte size telemetry files, I have some pretty, you know, optimized reader stuff to do that, which I did in C. So that concludes the TCL portion of my talk. Probably not completely, but just that's the tie-in, is this thing that I'm going to keep coming back to as my tool, T-Ball, is, you know, is very much an application. Cliff's, you know, talk yesterday about how you build something that has TCL and C stuff merged together and intimately connected, you know, it's exactly that. This is the trajectory for the Deep Space One spacecraft. We launched the thing and had about a one-year time period in which we did tests of the spacecraft. And basically, the objective was to fly the thing from launch over here, partway around the sun, to an encounter with an asteroid about a year later. And we did that. We got the ion engine working. We had, boy, a lot of adventures on the way. The spacecraft was kind of a rickety bucket of bolts that we had to keep, you know, taping things back onto to keep it working. We had, at one point, we started writing, you know, these anomalies on the board whenever they happened, and, you know, it seemed like we were having two or three major, like, oh my gosh, are we going to lose the spacecraft anomalies a week? But the spacecraft held together pretty well. Slightly after this flyby, though, about a year after we launched, we had a failure of the star tracker. And the star tracker is crucial to my business. It's a camera that you take pictures of the sky, and you know, take a long exposure picture of the sky so you can see stars in it. And the software on the spacecraft recognizes the constellations, the pattern of stars, and figures out what the orientation of the spacecraft is. That's the fundamental way on a spacecraft that we that we figure out its orientation. There's other backup things that use, you know, sun sensors and less accurate ways to do it, but that's the way you do it normally for precision applications. And Deep Space One had just one of these things, star trackers, on board, and when that thing failed, we were sunk in terms of being able to do other stuff with the spacecraft, because you need to be able to know the orientation of the spacecraft to point the ion engine in the right direction to thrust to go anywhere. We had been planning to do this flyby of a comet called Borelli that was a couple of years in the future, and that star tracker failure was like, it was a crippling thing. And so what we ended up doing was writing, essentially rewriting the flight software to replace that functionality with a whole other approach to figuring out the spacecraft orientation. And what that was is we wrote software that would take pictures of stars, of a single star, actually, with the science camera. Now, a star tracker camera normally is a wide field of view, like a pair of binoculars. You can see a bunch of stars in it. But the science camera is like a telephoto lens. It's a really narrow little field of view. And so to make this new software work, we had to take pictures of just, you get a star in the center of the field of view and take pictures of it and then try and make sure you keep the star in there and stay locked on it. But before we could do any of that, I mean, we kind of conceived that, we could write software that did all this stuff and people went off and started working on it, but we couldn't even really communicate with the spacecraft at that point, because the spacecraft, when the star tracker failed, went into this thing called safe mode. Safe mode, typically spacecraft are designed so if you have a failure on board them, they have, you know, in the software they detect that failure. And it's kind of like coming up in safe mode on your PC or something. There's a very reduced functionality that just basically keeps the spacecraft alive. And in our case, what that is on Deep Space One is it just points the solar panels at the sun and slowly spins the spacecraft end over end to make sure that the antennas occasionally drag across the Earth and we can have communication. So what this is a plot of is the plot of the signal strength as a function of time as the antennas swing around the sky and maybe cross across the Earth. And we figured out this kooky way using this T-ball tool that I built to, if we have the geometry just right and we set the orientation of the spacecraft just right, that we can see the Huygens antenna when it swings across the Earth. And that's what this little spike here is. This is a antenna pattern. The spacecraft's rotating, and it just drags the Huygens antenna across the Earth, and you can see the side lobes in the antenna pattern. Any of you Wi-Fi guys maybe know about that. But and then that's the peak. That's where the antenna got as close, you know, to the Bohr site on the Earth as it could. And we figured out that if we set the geometry up right, we could drag the Huygens antenna, which is only a degree or two across the Earth. And if we were really crafty, we could send a command with the corrections for the light time and how long it takes to happen on the spacecraft to stop the thing with the Huygens antenna pointed at Earth. And then, you know, sending commands when we started to be drifting off, we could kind of keep the thing balanced with the Huygens antenna pointed at Earth. And the reason that that was crucial, the fundamental reason that that was crucial, is in order to load this new software and do all of the stuff that we needed to do to fix the spacecraft, you had to have Huygens antenna communications. The Huygens antenna communications were, 6,000 bits per second, 10,000 bits per second, where on the low gain antenna, which you normally use in safe mode, it's 10 bits per second. So you can imagine trying to upload a flight software image to the spacecraft at 10 bits per second is not, really a tractable attractable thing. So having this capability to do the geometry visualization and figure out all these angles of where stuff is in the sky was really crucial to being able to recover the spacecraft. And we were rewarded for all of that hard work. I mean, it was a couple of years of just, you know, a lot of desperate activity. I think we recovered the spacecraft, got this new flight software on board, figured out a way to operate it, and got the ion engine running again to thrust so that we could get to the comet encounter. I think we had just a few days worth of time left. You know, we had to start the thrusting on a certain date or we weren't going to be able to make the comet encounter. And so here, the next few frames here are pictures as we approached Borelli. At the time, this was these were the highest resolution pictures of a comet nucleus anybody had ever taken. The only other comet flyby was one that was done by Halley during its last apparition. You can see as we get a little bit closer here and the nucleus becomes resolved, that you can start to see jets coming off of the nucleus there. They're stretched for that. There's the close-up, highest resolution picture of, I like to think of it as a chicken leg. But boy, there's a lot going on the surface there. I mean, you can see that there's this smooth, flat area, and we'll see that that kind of appear again in the Temple 1 pictures. But there's a lot going on a comet nucleus. I was one of the things I was surprised to learn when I started doing this stuff with comets. That's a series we did as we fly by. We get pictures from several different angles, and that's put together into movies. So you can kind of get a feeling for the 3D nature of the nucleus there. Comets are black. I mean, you think of comets a snowball, you know, but it's a dirty snowball, and it's a dirty snowball that's been sitting out in the sun, and all the water and volatiles have been baking off of the surface and leaving behind just the carbon and, organic stuff. And that stuff is black, tarry, darker, actually, than you can make a surface on Earth. It's, just a few percent. The albedo for Borelli is like 3%. And as a result of that, it's surprisingly hot. The surface of the comet sitting out there in the sun is what, you know, it's like you can imagine you have a flat black car sitting out in the desert in the sun. It's going to get hot. And it's, you know, hot enough that if you put your hand on the surface, you go, yikes, that's, you know, it's like I think it's like 150 degrees Fahrenheit. So after Deep Space One, I finagled my way onto the Mars Rover project. And I carried this T-ball tool along with me and said, well, I'll make a new version of it that's, you know, oriented around doing the flying the Mars rovers to Mars. And there you see it up on the wall in the control room on I forget which landing day this is, but the landing day for one of the two rovers. This version now is had to have quite a few changes because the spacecraft is very different. The Mars rovers flew to Mars in this wrapped in a heat shield and a back shell, and the spacecraft actually spins, is spin stabilized, where Deep Space One is what we call a three-axis spacecraft, which holds its orientation. The Mars rovers are spin stabilized, and they have thrusters on the side that you can use to process the spin axis of the spacecraft around and orient it to different things. No science instruments really on the outside of the spacecraft, but there's a star tracker. Here's the field of view of the star tracker, and we had to worry a lot about where the stars were and It's hard to see a little bit in this, but there's blue numbers here, which are the star numbers and magnitudes of them. And so I ended up using this tool to plan the sequence of attitudes that we would turn the spacecraft to during the flight to Mars to make sure that we had attitude knowledge. I also use this to do the planning for all of the TCMs and stuff we did to correct the trajectory on the way to Mars. That was kind of my primary responsibility, was implementing all those TCMs and stuff. And this ended up being, you know, just really, really handy to be able to do this 3D visualization stuff. We did what's called an ORT, which is essentially a dry run. It's a test for the flight team, where the managers get together and say, well, let's give them a scenario that they have to solve. And the scenario that we had to solve, we had a thruster on the side of the spacecraft that exploded and caused another part of the cooling system to start leaking and mess up the spacecraft's attitude. It was a whole convoluted set of failures that, you know, we were, I was able to kind of take the telemetry and put it in this thing and go, it did that, huh? Well, that looks like maybe one of the thrusters blew up. You know, and the guys went, you know, oh, man, it only took him 8 minutes, you know. He was pretty, they were disappointed a little bit that it didn't take us longer to sort it out. So that's the, cruise thing. So we're starting, you know, we're flying these things to Mars, and I'm going, I'm going to be out of work here if I don't figure out something to do with the rover on the surface. And so I thought, well, I bet there's some utility in having this kind of a visualization thing for the rover sitting on the surface. It turns out that there is some work for attitude control guys to do, even if you're sitting in a car on the surface of Mars, because the rover needs to be able to point the Huygens antenna back at the Earth and be able to track the Earth during the course of the day as it passes over the rover, and you need to be able to keep track of how the rover is tilted and which direction it's facing on the surface. You can't do that with a compass on Mars, because Mars doesn't really have much of a magnetic field. So the way we do it is we take pictures with a camera of the sun, and we take several pictures over the course of several minutes and watch the sun move across the sky, and then do a bunch of geometry to figure out what's the orientation of the rover from that. And there's actually some gyros on the rover and that stuff. So there's, you know, it turns out there's attitude control stuff to do even on the surface of Mars. And there's a picture of this tool adapted for the Mars rover stuff. You can see, now the spacecraft becomes the rover sitting on the surface of Mars. And I've got, south and west and north marked on here, and you can see this is where the Earth is just coming up over the horizon, and the track it's going to take across the sky as a function of time. Here's a picture of it with the rover climbing a hill as we did the Spirit rovers, you know, of course, climbed the Columbia Hills, and we spent a fair amount of time with substantial tilt on the rover. You can also see some outlines here, and those are outlines that have to do with the Huygens antenna pointing constraints. The Huygens antenna is like a ping pong paddle that has a two-axis gimbal. It has a wrist gimbal and a gimbal like that that lets it swing around and point at different azimuths. And you can actually flip the antenna paddle part of it more than 180 degrees, so you can point at the Earth sometimes in two different configurations. You can point at it that way, or, you know, forehand or backhand. And depending on where other, you know, the orientation of the rover and stuff, one of those or the other might be better to do. And I'll show you an example of that. I don't know how visible it is. There's a kind of a close-up of the Huygens antenna gimbal. Let's see. So if you see the differences there between those two views, if you imagine that we're looking from the Earth, you can see that in this configuration, the Huygens antenna is being blocked by the camera mast. But in that configuration, it's groovy. And so that's what these colored circles up here are doing, is they're telling you, oh, if you're on branch A configuration of the Huygens antenna, then the Earth, if it's over there, doesn't have any blockage from the antenna mast. And, you know, as it turned out, when they started planning, you know, when we started to figure out how do you plan where the rover's going to drive and that sort of stuff, looking at those constraints ended up being in the decision tree. Oh, okay, we need to drive 4 meters over there, but if you park just the way you drove, then we're going to have a problem with the Huygens antenna pointing. It'll be behind the camera mast. So you guys, when we get to the end of the drive, can you turn 30 degrees to the right, and then that'll solve our little problem for us. So we ended up doing a fair amount of that kind of work. Another little story from the MERD days was that one day we had a fault on the spacecraft with the Huygens antenna, one of the Huygens antenna gimbals. The way they work normally is when you start up the Huygens antenna gimbal to go track the Earth, it drives the gimbal over to the stop, and when it feels the current going up in the motor because it hit the stop, it says, oh, I must have hit the stop, and it resets the little counter that keeps track of its position. And then one day when we went to track the Earth, we didn't have any signal. There was no communications, and we're like, holy cow, what's up with that? Why didn't we get hear from the rover today? And, you know, it takes a whole Mars day to, you know, sort out, oh, we had that problem, huh? We need to figure out what's going on. And then we got the telemetry down from the spacecraft, and we figured out that the place that it actually pointed the antenna wasn't where the Earth was in the sky. And we're like, huh, that's weird. Why did that happen? And we figured out that somehow when the Huygens antenna went to be calibrated, instead of driving all the way over to the stop and zeroing the counter, you know, it was kind of too sticky. It didn't. It tripped that current sensor right away and zeroed the counter in its starting position, which left it, you know, pointing in a kooky place when it went to try and point at the Earth. And, you know, when that was all going on, I came in and started looking at what the geometry of the rover was, using T-ball here, and I discovered that the Huygens antenna mast was casting a shadow in the morning across the gimbals in the base of the Huygens antenna. I said, if you oriented this so you were looking from the sun, and you'd say, wow, gosh, there's that the Huygens antenna. Oh, okay, I know what it is. The Huygens antenna had a shadow across it in the morning, and so the sunlight didn't warm it up like it normally does. The lubricant was cold, so the friction in the gimbal was probably high. And so when it went to calibrate the Huygens antenna, it overcurrent the motor too early and reset the counters, and then after that, the Huygens antenna was pointed the wrong place during the whole track. And I was able, by being able to visualize the geometry, was able to very quickly figure that all out and went to the, you know, project manager guys and said, well, here's what I think happened, you know. And it was another one of those things where they went, how did you do that so fast? You know, it was fun. It was fun to be able to, a lot of this spacecraft operation stuff, the process of it would be very familiar to you all because it is exactly like debugging software. You get some weird set of outputs and you go, why did it do that? And, you know, sometimes you can make some sort of a little experiment to try and, you know, puzzle out. But basically, you're doing scientific method. You develop some sort of a theory for the bug that you have, and then you go and you either fix it directly and see, did my fix work? Oh, okay, then I have the right theory. Or you think of some other little experiment that you can do to validate that your understanding of the problem is right. But, you know, debugging a spacecraft, it has a little bit of hardware in the loop, but it's basically the same as debugging your tickle scripts, except, of course, it's on Mars and there's a half-hour light delay and some stuff like that. I don't know if any of you can read this. There's always the question of documentation. And, you know, as I started working on this T-ball thing and starting to let other people start to use it, people would say, well, do you have any kind of a manual for this? And, you know, you never have time to sit down and really write a detailed user manual. But somewhere on the web, I found this thing that was pretty applicable. And what I did, I just went and cut and replaced every place the word astrolabe appeared. I put T-ball in, and I changed Lewis, the name Lewis with my buddy Tony, who's one of the guys that I work with a lot at work, who does a lot of T-ball stuff as well. And Lewis was Geoffrey Chaucer's nephew. And this was written by him in 1390 and is a detailed description of how to operate an astrolabe written in Middle English. And so once I made those search and replaces, I delivered this to him and said, well, I finally finished the T-ball documentation. And it's, you know, 100 pages of Middle English, you know. And he's like, I started reading it, I couldn't believe that you had sat down and written all of that. So how am I doing on time here? So now let me talk a little bit about the most recent project I worked on, which is Deep Impact. Deep Impact is a project to blast a hole in a comet. The reason that that's interesting to do is because nobody knows very much about the surface properties of comets. I worked for a while on a project that was going to try and land on the surface of a comet, and we went to the comet science guys and said, well, we know the gravity's really low, so we need to anchor to the surface, so tell us what the surface of a comet is like. And they said, well, it's somewhere between cotton candy and concrete. Somewhere in there is, you know, kind of what the surface properties. So we're like, okay. So our job is design an anchoring system that'll work anywhere between cotton candy and concrete. And people came up with ways to do that. You know, you can make a harpoon thing that's driven by an explosive charge and has a wire on it. And if it's hard, the thing goes in 6 inches and sticks. And if it's soft, the harpoon goes out to the end of the cord and turns sideways, and so they came up with ways to do it. But they really, the folks that work with comets, at this juncture now, in the last couple of years, had seen close-up pictures of 3 comet nuclei, and they had seen Borelli, which we took pictures of. VILD-2, and the pictures of Halley. And so the comet science guys, you know, really are just in the infancy of their science in a lot of ways. So the idea was, well, we'll build a spacecraft. Spacecraft will have a kind of a missile on the bottom of it, a little probe that has its own attitude control system, is really a standalone spacecraft, and will fly by the comet with the main spacecraft and drop the probe off and have the probe hit the comet and take pictures of what happens and see if we can't get a picture of the crater that gets formed turns out that you can tell a lot about the surface properties by looking at how the crater forms, the angle at which stuff comes off varies depending on whether the surface is hard or soft, how much material comes off, how big the chunks are in it, and that sort of stuff is all real interesting science information. And so we built this spacecraft, Ball Engineering in Colorado built it. And there were several challenges to the thing. One was that it was a very, very short cruise. I mean, we had a year on Deep Space One between launch and the encounter. In this case, we only had like 6 months. And that means you got to calibrate the spacecraft and figure out how to operate it and get all of the mission operations stuff in order in that amount of time, and that's really, really challenging. So there is the Deep Impact version of T-Ball. Same basic deal. There's a couple of science instruments that have fields of view that you have to worry about. This spacecraft has reaction wheels and, you know, basically turns by spinning a big weighted gyroscope for a set of four of them, and that's used to orient the spacecraft as opposed to firing thrusters. Deep Space One controlled its attitude with thrusters, so that's a little different, and this big vector here lets you keep track of where the angular momentum is for that set of wheels. And there's radiators for the infrared spectrometer and a bunch of stuff on the backside of the spacecraft that you have to make sure stay out of the sun. And I built a version of it for the impactor. There's the little part, our missile. It's basically a chunk of copper with an attitude control system on it. Has some big thrusters and a star camera and a science camera to take pictures with, and lock on to the comet with its little guidance system. And here's an example of the sort of stuff that you end up doing with this 3D visualization. That is a plot of the, let's see, what's a good way to describe this? Each one of those colored dots is a possible first trajectory correction that we might have to do with the spacecraft. When you launch a spacecraft, you're trying to fly it to this comet encounter. You have to make little corrections to the trajectory. You can't just expect the launch vehicle to perfectly hit the velocity that you want. And so you launch the thing with the launch vehicle. You track it with the antennas on the Earth, and you say, oh, okay, we're going a little bit to the left, so we need to correct a little bit to the right, and the navigators figure out, okay, I want you to go 6 meters per second in this particular inertial direction. And we say, okay, and I'll go and figure out the commands to do that with the spacecraft. When they build the launch vehicle, the launch vehicle has a set of requirements for how good it can deliver its, you know, the spacecraft to a particular position and velocity. And they give you a big table that says, well, I think we might be 20%, you know, I think 20% of the cases will be a meter per second too fast, and 5% of the cases will be 3 meters per second too fast. So they give you a whole set of statistics for how good the launch vehicle can do. And I took that set of statistics and turned them into this plot, which is my perspective on implementing all of the possible initial conditions. So basically what this is we have to, I know that we have a trajectory correction that's planned for 3 weeks after launch. And this is a kind of a statistical model of what that might have to look like. These are all the different directions that I might have to do a delta V. some visualization on the sky of where they are. It's pretty likely that I'll have to do one right around here. Not so likely that I'll have to do one in that direction. They're color-coded with information about the constraints. The ones that are in the red here are ones that are too close to the sun for me to do with this spacecraft, because the solar panels won't get enough light to charge the batteries, that sort of stuff. The ones that are green are ones that are okay to do, but that only have low-gain antenna coverage, and you know, so on and so forth. The different colors have different meanings, but I can look at that set there and say, oh, okay, if we, you know, on the real launch day, we start tracking the spacecraft, the nav guys start giving me information that says, oh, the delta V is over here somewhere. I say, oh, okay, that's a dark blue one. That means I have high-gain antenna coverage, I can do the delta V, and everything's groovy. On the other hand, if they start giving me, you know, their early estimates and it's one of these red ones, then I got to run around and think of plan B for how am I going to do that. I got to break up the maneuver into two burns or that or something like that. Let's see, what's next? Here's me and my buddy Ed standing in front of the spacecraft down at the Cape. I got to go down to the Cape this time. Usually I'm stuck in Pasadena and, you know, working with the telemetry and desperately trying to get ready for launch, and so I don't ever get to see the rocket, but I got to this time. This is our little missile, our probe, that is being put up underneath the bottom of the spacecraft, and there's the spacecraft being stacked onto the top of the launch vehicle. And I got to go out. Actually, got to go out on the pad and stick my head up underneath the solid rocket motor. It's like, wow, that's a big bomb. And you know, you go up on the tower, and the side of the Delta II, you know, you can't even reach your arms around it. You know, it's like a huge cylinder from floor to ceiling, and there's a little channel that about that big that runs along the side. And you go, huh? I guess that's probably the destruct package. Maybe I'll stand around here on the other side of the rocket, you know. But that it was pretty cool. And just going out to Kennedy and seeing the old launch pads, you know, all the old Mercury and Apollo launch pads and stuff is pretty pretty impressive. There's the thing stacked the morning before we launched. A couple pictures of the launch. So I was standing right down there. It's the actual pad. You go, yeah, this is a launch pad, all right, because there's a concrete floor and it has all these gouges and burn marks and stuff in it. I mean, it's like there's no doubt in your mind. It's like, you know, it looks like it's been blowtorched, every square inch of it. There's no doubt in your mind that it's a launch pad. You're out there. So this is the sort of stuff that we spend a lot of time trying to figure out. That's a random telemetry plot. It's the attitude errors and the rate errors. And something happened right here. It's pretty easy to see. Something went sklunk. And, you know, my job typically is to try and figure out, well, what caused that? And is it something that's going to mess us up when we're trying to take pictures of this comet flyby? And one of the things that I kind of added to this T-ball tool on this last project was the capability to make telemetry plots like this. The existing telemetry plotting capability at JPL is, you know, now getting to be 20 years old, and you know, and I just really wanted to have something that I could zoom in really easily. A lot of guys at JPL use MATLAB for this, and that's pretty good, but it doesn't interface real well with the telemetry system, and there's not really any way to use it in real time when you're getting telemetry in from the spacecraft. you can't just have MATLAB continue to swallow the data. So I built this thing, and it uses the same technology, all the same pieces under the hood as my T-ball stuff. The TCL stuff is used for the event loop and all the dragging and all of that stuff. And I'll show you a little bit of a demo of that in a second. Here's a close-up of one of the many. Here's the star trackers. These are our star cameras. This spacecraft was smart enough to include two of them, but there was we had a little problem with that, actually, because when they built the spacecraft, there was some documentation that described how the things are actually, the focal planes are actually mounted in the camera relative to the base plate. And somehow, when they built the flight software and all of the validation test stuff, there was a 90-degree rotation that got left out. And so we got the thing up in space, and everything seemed to sort of be working, except that, the two star trackers are mounted so that they point in slightly different directions. And right after launch, the spacecraft is in a configuration where it's rotating slowly, and the Earth goes through each of these star tracker fields of view. And when the Earth gets in there, the Earth is big and really bright and blocks the stars out. And so they alternately drop out, each of the two star trackers. One at a time, you always have one of them that's working. But what we saw is when both star trackers were away from the Earth, everything looked fine. But when one of them got on the Earth, then the attitude jumped to some crazy other orientation, had a 90-degree rotation in it. And I was able to, look at this stuff in T-ball and say, oh, when we cross the Earth over here, there's a 90-degree rotation, and very quickly figured out that something's wrong with the data that we're getting from the star trackers, and traced it back to that documentation problem. And it turned out that the way the flight software was written, when both trackers were working, it kind of was averaging the answers between the two in such a way that rotation about the bore site didn't affect the answer. But when just one of them was working, then that you could see that error. So this is basically what we do. We zoom by the comet with the flyby spacecraft. We release the impactor about a day before we get there. We make a 100 meter per second delta V with the flyby spacecraft so that we don't hit the comet with the flyby spacecraft too. And the impactor hits the comet going 10 kilometers a second and gets vaporized and blows a big hole in the comet. There's a close-up of the nucleus of Temple 1, and the pictures, projected here are a little bit hard to see, but there are these big smooth flat regions which existed on Borelli as well. You can see kind of for scale, that's about a kilometer kilometer in size. The eventual impact point was right down here. And there's the result of the impact. The scientists were astonished to find that nothing came out of the impact. One of the things they were going to look at is, well, how big do the chunks that come out of the comet, how big are they, and that sort of stuff. Nothing came out bigger than talcum powder. It essentially went poof, which, between that and being able to look at the dynamics of how the ejecta come out, the fan of stuff that comes out during the impact as the crater is being formed, they were able to figure out that the surface strength of the comet is less than flour, baking flour. Like, you can take baking flour and you put your thumb in it and leave a little cliff. Well, that's way stronger than comets. So when they told us that it was somewhere between cotton candy and concrete, they were lying to us because it's way weaker than cotton candy. Cotton candy is way stronger in comparison. So that's the end of that part. So let me. Did I just show that? So let me. So that's the pictures taken from the impactor, from our little missile. And you can see at the end there, we stay pretty stable, and then just before we hit, there's a couple of little attitude disturbances. And I actually went back and put those back together and, you know, figured out where they were on the surface and converted them to the spacecraft orientation, and I think we were hit by three dust impacts. The first couple ones were, you know, milligram size things, and the last particle was like maybe a gram, that blew a big hole in the impactor when that hit us, because a gram going 10 kilometers per second, you know, is a lot of kinetic energy. Short. A couple of times. Kaboom. And then this is my favorite, I think. This is a real high time resolution thing. You can sort of see there's a little puff of gas that comes out, and that, you know, the impactor goes into the comet, leaving behind a little channel behind it, and the impactor comes to a stop, deposits its energy into the comet, and there's a little jet of gas that poofs back out through that hole. Poof. And then that's the actual fan of the ejecta from the crater forming. So I guess let me stop there and answer some questions. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And there were solid lines and dash lines. Solid lines where you're running the engine, and dash lines where you're coasting.
I don't remember which is which, but yes, that was what that was. And there are, typically for those low thrust trajectories, there's, you know, sections where you really need to thrust and sections where it's okay to coast. We discovered on DS1 that we were desperately low on conventional propellant. The spacecraft has hydrazine, you know, regular rocket fuel that it uses for the attitude control thrusters, and then xenon, which it uses for the ion engine. And, you know, we spent a lot of time in the safe mode and stuff like that, and that used up a whole bunch of our hydrazine conventional propellant. And part of our recovery went, oh, man, we're going to be really low on hydrazine. But when we run the ion engine, we use only like a third of the hydrazine because the ion engine can actually control the attitude, gimbal around and control the attitude. So for the periods where we were supposed to be coasting, instead of actually shutting off the ion engine, we ran the ion engine and thrusted north for a week, and then thrusted south for a week, and then north for a week, and then south for a week, just to save conventional propellant. Yeah. It requires a fair amount of work to adapt it. It's not fully like all table driven, and I kind of think that's the right architectural choice in a way, because in order to make it general enough that I could table drive any conceivable future project, the thing would then be like Microsofty, you know, too many features, you know. I don't know if that makes any sense, but so I kind of decided on purpose in a way that that rather than making everything completely table driven or, you know, turn this option on, turn that option off, that I would just say, well, okay, I'm going to just, you know, I'll recode the little thing that, like the reference frame, you know, the reference frames are an example. The rovers have a very different tree of reference frames than a spacecraft does. You have to worry about the surface of Mars and where the rover is on Mars and stuff. And so I just recode that stuff. That reminds me. Let me do this too. This is a little bit more. Let me just take 5 minutes to drive this a little bit so you can kind of get a better feel. It's hard to see from the still pictures, but this is more how T-ball really works. Is, you know, it's a very, you know, you just drag it around from whatever perspective you want to look at. If you want to look at the details of a particular field of view, you can zoom in. You know, that's a middle mouse button drag thing, and I'm zoomed in on the field of view of the camera that took those pictures, you know, zooming in and hitting the comet. That's the field of view of that. This is the telemetry display stuff, and it has the capability to, you know, has the same kind of user interface in the sense that I can just drag my plots around on the paper, and I can zoom in on the plots in time, or zoom in on the, you know, change the scale very, very dynamically there. And I set the stuff up so that the two things are coupled. So as you can see, as I drag my plot around here, the center of the plot defines a time, and the 3D display matches the telemetry from that time. So what's going on specifically in this particular data set, this is from the spacecraft when we separated the little probe from the main spacecraft. And so as I scroll along here in time, what you'll see is the spacecraft is the probe is tumbling, and then the thrusters come on, and then the spacecraft turns back to the attitude that it's supposed to be at with the comet in the field of view. And then let me zoom way out here, track down here a ways in time. So, and then this is now a day later. So I got, you know, a couple days worth of telemetry loaded in here. And now this is the first correction that the little probe did. Probe is taking pictures of the comet as it's approaching it and saying, oh, I'm going a little bit off to the left. And it can actually, has its own guidance system on it and can say, oh, I'm going to make a correction. So this is the first correction to the trajectory that the probe made on its own. And what it does is it rolls around the comet boresight and fires some thrusters and then rolls back. You can actually see down here, I think, as it does that, here's the purple thing down here is the Star Tracker field of view, and if you zoom in on the Star Tracker field of view, you can see there's a set of blobs there, and let me turn some stars on here. So there's the stars, you know, from a star catalog, and what the Star Tracker is seeing in its data stream. Oh, I've identified these stars and I'm tracking them. I don't know if that makes any sense, but there's a lot of stars out there, you guys. So that's a little bit of a feeling for what T-ball is like in real time. So this plugged into the telemetry stream, I can sit there when the spacecraft is doing something and, you know, watch the spacecraft as it turns, which is like, oh, yeah, we're going the right direction. In fact, we did an early rehearsal of the encounter, and the spacecraft was supposed to turn to an attitude and release the probe, and I had this thing set up and was right after I came on the project, and we're looking at the stuff, and I said, do you guys realize that the spacecraft like released the probe in the wrong direction? And they're like, what? No, look at that. No, it couldn't have. You know, like, no, it's the wrong way around. There was a problem in the sequence that they had, and you know, I mean, they've looked at it as a bunch of numbers, and it's like not obvious, you know, when it's just a pile of numbers going by on the screen. But you know, with a 3D visualization, it's like, no, the probe's supposed to go toward the comet. So, other questions? Yeah. No, no, I think it's possible. Somebody will do it. It will certainly be informed, you know, what we need to do it will certainly be informed by this. And now they'll be like, oh, gosh, we got to worry about whether we'll sink in dust, you know, over our heads, and how do we deal with that? Yeah. No.
Can you repeat the question for the listening audience?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thanks for that reminder. He said, the question was, do we think all comets have the same very fine consistency of the surface material? And we really don't know. We only have detailed information for one of them. There's certainly large differences between all four of the comet nuclei that we have detailed up-close knowledge of, and so it's not clear. There may be some that have very different fundamental properties and that are, you know, much stronger surface materials. Yeah?
Was there measurable deflection of the comet?
I think the answer to that is no, that there was some deflection of the comet. You know, you can compute from F equals MA how big it must have been. But I don't think that we can track the position of the comet accurately enough to be able to see that. It's like a mosquito in front of a semi. You know, the comet, mass of the comet is so large compared to the mass of the impactor that the momentum stuff, you know, there's not very much momentum exchange there. So we didn't change the trajectory of the comet in a way that's really significant. Yeah.
You spoke of a 1 gram particle.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty unusual event. Where would that come from?
Yeah, he was asking about a 1 gram particle, and you know whether that was an unusual event. I'm sorry.
A moon, perhaps.
You know, it's in a way that is paradoxical with the fact that the stuff that came off of the surface was all this very fine stuff. So I guess that means that must be a 1 gram little dust ball, you know, dust bunny. clearly, you know, there's stuff that is active on comets. There are jets that form. We could see outbursts from the comet as we were approaching. I have a movie of that where there's little flashes. Poof, flash, outburst movie. Let me just run this quick. So this is taken from the pictures that we were using for navigation to try and get to the comet. In the center of the field of view is the comet. And you'll see there's several little outbursts where there's a puff of gas or dust that came off. And they think that that's associated with a particular part of the comet coming into the sun. And as the sun comes up over this particular area, it causes the stuff to come off. So presumably that kind of process can lift, you know, material up off the surface. Yeah.
So what do you think the surface temperature is sort of about at the time of this experiment?
At the time of the impact, yeah. The stuff that was out in the sun is hot to the touch. It's 120, 150 degrees Fahrenheit. The stuff that's on the backside, cold side of the comet is very cold. It has, you know, real low thermal conductivity. Not much heat passes through the comet. So this very light, fluffy stuff is going to cool off real fast once it gets out of the sun. I don't have a number in my head for that, for the temperature of the cold side. Yeah.
So how much code is all
this? Oh, I should know that. Well, there's probably 20 source files. The TCL stuff to do the user interface is pretty simple. It's in two or three files, you know. I mean, I could do a line count for you pretty quick, but yeah.
When you rewrite it for a new vehicle or a new application, are you writing script or are you hacking the C or both?
Both. The TCL stuff doesn't change that much in general. Typically, each new adaptation, there's a bunch of I call them packages because I worked on an ADA project for a while and kind of got in this concept of, I mean, one C source file is an object in some sense, and it has a interface and kind of just a little pile of data that goes along with it, and it's and there's a bunch of those that don't ever change, that are the low-level tools that draw a sphere and draw objects on the sphere and draw 3D things. And then there's a few modules that I do a lot of changing on, like the stuff that does the different reference frames, my little model of the spacecraft in OpenGL, which, you know, someday I'll learn how to import models that other people have built or something, but right now I just like write explicit OpenGL code. The TCL stuff tends to not change that much, though oftentimes a new project I will make a bunch of new TCL commands that are implemented in C that do things that are kind of specific to that project. Like, for example, on the Mars rover version, I'm sorry, the Mir cruise version, the way you say where is the spacecraft pointed is you point the spin axis at some particular Ariane deck. And so I have a TCL function that's implemented in C but passed out to the TCL interface that points the spin axis of the spacecraft at an Ariane deck. On Deep Impact, the way you say where the spacecraft is oriented is you give it a quaternion. You give it four numbers that define the full attitude of the thing. And so I have a function in there that does that. Does that sort of answer the question? Go ahead. Yeah. CVS. I philosophically, I'm kind of a Luddite, you know. I'm an engineer. I want to have something that sort of works, and so I work with my tool of most facility. I mean, and a bunch of people at JPL have said, well, we're going to make this whiz-bang thing that, you know, extends the capabilities of CVS to do all this fancy stuff. And I'm like, well, it was okay before. Just use it like regular, you know. And they make these crazy 5,000-page nested make files and stuff. And it's like, well, just make it simple. Because that way it's not so hard to fix, you know. But that's just my philosophy, yeah. Yeah, the place I think I was exposed to TCL originally was when we build a spacecraft, we always build some kind of a big simulation of it, a thing that we call the test bed. And the test bed usually has the flight computer, maybe an engineering model of the flight computer or the spare flight computer, and then another big computer stack that plugs into it that makes the flight software running in the spare computer think it's in space and simulates all of the instruments and thrusters and all of that stuff. And I worked on a project where we built that simulation software, and the guy that built it built the glue layer that took all the different models for all these different instruments and stuff. And it was glued together with this thing that had a TCL interface on it. And it kind of managed the event loop of it and running these different models and passing data from one to the other. And working with that, it was like, oh, man, it's so nice to have a scripting language as the front end. I tend to be a command line guy as opposed to a graphic user interface guy because, particularly in a testing environment, you want to be able to go do the exact same thing that you did yesterday again and not make any mistakes. Oh, I forgot to click this box before and pull down that thing. So TCL was like, oh, man, that's perfect because I can build a graphic user interface easily so that it's easy to do things one time and find with pull downs the stuff I want to do. But at the same time, I can script everything so that when I run my test in the test bed, I can do the exact same thing every time, you know, send this command, wait 18 seconds, check for this flag. If it's yes, then send that, you know. So I was exposed to it there, and that kind of sold me on the concept of having something that merged, you know, a user interface that had command line stuff and the graphic user interface stuff. Is that? Yeah. We're okay. Thanks. And I want to thank you, too, because you have given me over the years an enormous amount of help with TCL stuff for this. And without you, this would not have been possible. Okay. So I appreciate it.